June. North of the border, in Petite Italie, where everyone speaks French, it can be hard to remember where you are exactly. This was Montreal, outermost point on our elliptical vacation. Our Canadian relatives gamely asked what we wanted to see in their city, and we answered, food. We wondered what was available locally here at the threshold, to our southerly way of thinking, of the frozen tundra. We lit out for Chinatown and Little Italy. Here, as in the United States, the best shot at finding locally based cuisine seems to involve seeking out the people who recently moved here from someplace else. We passed a few restaurants that advertised Canadian food along with the principal ethnic fare. Our hosts explained this meant something like American food, more an absence than a presence of specific character. Not Chinese, not Italian. Is it true that American food means nothing? I pondered this as we walked down a street of Chinese shops where butchers pinned up limp, plucked ducks like socks on clotheslines, if your mind's eye can handle socks with feet and bills. It's easy enough to say what's not American cuisine. Anything with its feet still on, for starters. A sight like this on Main Street USA would send customers running the other way, possibly provoking lawsuits over psychological damage to children. As a concept, our national cuisine seems to be food without obvious biological origins, chosen for the color and shape of the sign out front, arches, bucket, or cowboy hat. That's the answer to the question, where did it come from? Of course, that's not the whole story. We have our New England clam chowder, Louisiana gumbo, southern collards and black-eyed peas, all regionally specific. But together, they don't add up to any amalgamated themes or national guidelines for enjoying what grows near us. The food cultures of other geographically diverse nations are not really one thing either. Italy is particularly famous for its many distinct regional specialties. But still, that whole country manages to export a cuisine that is recognizably Italian, unified by some basic ingredients, such as pasta, and an intrinsic attitude. We recognize the origins of other countries' meals when we see them, somehow sensing their spirit. Mamma mia, bon appetit, pass the salsa. If you ask a person from Italy, India, Mexico, Japan, or Sweden what food the United States has exported to them, they will all give you the same answer, and it starts with a mick. And it must be said, they're swallowing it. Processed food consumption is on the rise worldwide, proportional to growing affluence. French metro stations are plastered with ads for convenience foods. On a recent trip there, I queried audiences about the danger of France losing its traditional food ways and found them evenly divided between never and definitely. Working women my age and younger confessed to giving in to convenience, even though, as they put it, they knew better. They informed me that even the National Culinary Institute was going soft, having just announced that its chicken courses would no longer begin with Feathers, Feet, and Viscera 101. A flutter of conversation ran through the crowd over this point, a major recent controversy that had created radio call-in riots. I got an inkling that giving in to convenience means something different on that side of the pond. But still, these are real signs of change. Plenty of Parisians visit McDo every day, even though it's probably not the same customers going back every day. They're in for the novelty, not the food value. We are all, I suppose, dazzled by the idea of things other people will eat. There on the Montreal Chinatown sidewalk, we stop to admire what must have been 25-pound fish chasing each other's tails in slow motion in a half-barrel of water. Lily and my young nieces inspected them closely, then looked up at me with eyebrows raised in the age-old question, dinner or pets? I had no idea. We poked into shops that sold tea, dried mushrooms, and fabulous dresses that zip up the sides so tightly they look painted on. We ate lunch in a bustling cafeteria where the goods ranged from fried squid to jello. Later, we stopped in at a Lebanese market, which the kids also considered fine entertainment. They kept running up to show me intriguing edibles, powdered flowers in bottles, some kind of cola apparently made from beans, Greek mountain tea, which looked to me like a bunch of weeds in a cellophane bag. An enormous glass case ran the full width of the store across the back, displaying cheeses. No modest yellow blocks or wheels were these, but gigantic white tablets of cheese with the shape and heft of something Moses might have carried down from the mountain. Serious cheesemaking happened here, evidently. A young woman in a white apron stood ready to saw off a bit of goat, cow, or sheep cheese for me. We chatted, and she confirmed that these products were made in a kitchen nearby. I was curious about what kind of rennet and cultures were used for these Middle Eastern cheeses. She answered, but seemed puzzled. Most customers weren't interested in the technicalities. I confessed I had tried this at home. "You make cheese yourself," she repeated reverently. "You are a real housewife." It has taken me decades to get here, but I took that as a compliment. Our search kept us moving through Montreal's global neighborhoods until we arrived at the grand farmers market of Petite Italie. An arrangement of flowering plants near the entrance spelled out Benvenuto. Under an awning that covered several blocks, matrons with bulging bags crowded the aisles between open stalls spilling over with fresh goods. This was the place to shop, in any language. I tried French, since I don't speak Italian. Elles sont d'où, les tomates? D'ici, madame, from right here, Quebec, the vendors replied proudly again and again, except for one sardonic farmer who answered when I asked about his eggs. From chickens, madame. We were flat out amazed to see what enterprising Quebecois growers had managed to bring out already on the first official day of summer here in the recently frozen north. Asparagus, carrots, lettuce, rhubarb, hothouse tomatoes, and small sweet strawberries. Maple syrup and countless other maple products were also abundant, of course, here where a maple leaf is literally the flag. More surprising were the local apples, plenty of them, that had been stored since their harvest late last fall but still burst sweet and crisp under our teeth when we sampled them. English orchardists once prized certain apples for their late bearing and good storage qualities, varieties now mostly lost from the British Isles, crowded out by off-season imports from New Zealand. Evidently, the good storage heirlooms have not been lost from Quebec. I picked up a gargantuan head of broccoli. It looked too good to be true, but the cabbage family are cool-season crops. I asked the vendor where it came from. "L'Amérique du Sud, madame," he replied. "South America." Too bad, I thought. But really, South America, where it's either tropical or now wintertime? "Quel pays?" I asked him. "Which country?" "La Californie, madame." I laughed. It was a natural mistake. In the world map of produce, California might as well be its own country. A superpower, in fact. One state that exports more fresh produce than most countries of the world. If not for the fossil fuels involved, this culinary export could have filled me with patriotic pride. Our country is not only arches and cowboy hat, after all. We just don't get credit for this as American food, because vegetables are ingredients. The California broccoli would be diced into Asian stir-fries, tossed with Italian pasta primavera, or served with a bowl of mac and cheese, according to the food traditions of us housewives. Still, whether we get cultural points for them or not, those truckloads of California broccoli and artichokes bring winter cheer and vitamins to people in drearier climes all over the world. From now until September, the Quebecois would have local options, but in February, when the snow is piled up to the windowsills and it takes a heating pad on the engine block to get the car started, Fresh spinach and broccoli would be a welcome sight. I'd buy it if I lived here and fly the flag of La Californie in my kitchen. Even down in Dixie, I'd bought winter cucumbers before and would probably do it again. I wondered, once I was out of our industrial food dryout, would I be able to sample the world's vegetable delights responsibly as a social broccoli buyer without falling into dependency? California vegetables are not the serpent. It's all of us who open our veins to the flow of gas-fueled foods, becoming yawning addicts, while our neighborhood farms dry up and blow away. We seem to be built with a faulty gauge for moderation. In the market, we bought apples, maple syrup, bedding plants for our host's garden, and asparagus because the season was over at home. Like those jet-setters who fly across the country on New Year's Eve, we were going to cheat time and celebrate the moment more than once. Asparagus season, twice in one year, the dream vacation. We left Canada by way of Niagara Falls, pausing to contemplate this churning cataract that has presented itself to humans down through the ages as inspiration, honeymoon destination, and every so often a rip-snorting carnival ride. We got ourselves soaked on the Maid of the Mist and pondered the daring do of the 14 men, 2 women, and 1 turtle who have plunged over this crashing waterfall in conveyances including wooden barrels, a giant rubber ball, a polyethylene kayak, a diving bell, a jet ski, and in one case only jeans and a lightweight jacket. Both women and the turtle, reputed to be 105 years old, survived, as did 9 of the men, though the secret of success here is hard to divine. The jacket and jeans guy made it. The jet skier and the kayaker did not, nor did William Red Hill in his fancy rubber bubble. And a half-ton iron-bumpered barrel that safely delivered the turtle failed to save his inventive human companion. If there seems to be, running through this book, a suggestion that humans are a funny animal when it comes to respecting our own best interests, I rest my case. From the border, we traveled southwest across the wine country of New York and northern Pennsylvania, where endless vineyards flank the pebbled shore of Lake Erie. Another day's drive brought us into the rolling belly of Ohio, where we would be visiting friends on their dairy farm. Their rural county looked like a postcard of America's heartland, sent from a time when the heart was still healthy. Old farmhouses and barns stood as quiet islands in the undulating seas of corn, silvery oats, and auburn spelt. We pulled into our friend's drive under a mammoth silver maple. Lily sized up the wooden swing that twisted on 20-foot ropes from one of its boughs. A platoon of buff-colored hens ignored us, picking their way over the yard, while 3 old dogs trotted out to warn their mistress of our arrival. Elsie came around the corner, beaming her pure sunshine smile. "Rest on the porch," she said, drawing us glasses of water from the pump in the yard. "David is cultivating the corn, so there's no knowing when that will finish." We offered to help with whatever she'd been doing, so Elsie rolled the wheelbarrow to her garden and returned with a tall load of pea plants she had just pulled. We pulled lawn chairs into a circle under the cherry trees, lifted piles of vines into our laps, and tackled the shelling. Peas are a creature of spring, content to germinate in cold soil and flourish in cool, damp days. But heat causes them to stop flowering, set the last of their pods, and check out. Though nutritionally similar, peas and beans inhabit different seasons. In most gardens, the peas are all finished before the first bean pod is ready to be picked. That's a good thing for the gardener, since each of these plants, in its high season, will bring you to your knees on a daily basis. Tall, withered pea vines are a sigh from the end of spring, a pause before the beans, squash, and tomatoes start rolling. We caught up on news while steadily popping peas from their shells. Over our heads hung Stark's gold cherries the size of silver dollars. The central Ohio season was a week or so behind ours, and it was drier here, too. Elsie reported they'd had no rain for nearly a month, a fairly disastrous course for June, a peak growing time for crops and pastures. A few storms had gathered lately but then dissipated. The afternoon was still. No car passed on the road. No tractor churned a field within earshot. It's surprising how selectively the human ear attends to human-made sounds. Speech, music, engines. An absence of those is what we call silence. Maybe in the middle of a city or a chemically sterilized cornfield, it really is quiet when all the people and engines cease. But in that particular dot on the map, I was struck with how full a silence could be. A Carolina wren sang from the eave of the shed. Cedar waxwings carried on whispery bickerings up in the cherry. A mockingbird did an odd jerky dance, as if seized by the bird spirit, out on the driveway. The pea bowl rang like an insistent bell as we tossed in our peas. We heard mooing as 30 caramel brown Jersey cows came up the lane. Elsie introduced her daughter Emily and son-in-law Hirsch, who waved but kept the cows on course toward the milking barn. Lily and I shook pea leaves off our laps and followed. Emily and Hirsch, who live next door, do the milking every day at 5 a.m. and p.m. Emily coaxed the cows like children into the milking parlor. "Come on, Lisette, careful with your feet," and warned me to step back from Esau, the bull. "He's very bossy, and he doesn't like women," she said. "I don't think the cows care much for him either, for the same reason, but he sires good milkers." While Emily moved the cows through, Hirsch attached and moved the pipelines of the milking machine. During lulls, the couple sat down together on a bench while their toddler, Noah, bumped through the milking parlor and adjacent rooms, bouncing off door jams and stall sides in his happy orbit. Lily helped him into a toddler swing that hung in the doorway. The milking machine made a small hum, but otherwise the barn was quiet, save for the jostling cows munching hay. The wood of the barn looked 100 years old, dusty and hospitable. I couldn't imagine, myself, having an unbreakable milking date with every 5 o'clock of this world, but Emily seemed not to mind it. "We're so busy the rest of the day, going different directions," she said. "The milking gives us a time for Hirsch and me to sit a minute." A busy little pride of barn cats gathered near the bench, tails waving, to lap up milk pipe overflows collected in a pie plate. I watched a few 100 gallons of Jersey milk throbbing and flowing upward through the maze of clear, flexible pipes, like a creamy circulatory system. A generator-powered pump drew the milk from the cow's udders into a refrigerated stainless steel tank. The truck from an organic cooperative comes to fetch it to the plant, where it is pasteurized and packed into green and white cartons. Where it may go from there is anyone's guess. Our own supermarket back home stocks the brand, so over the years our family may have purchased milk that came from this barn, or at least some molecules of it mixed in with milk from countless other farms. As long as it meets the company's standards, with a consistent cream percentage and nominal bacterial counts, milk from this farm becomes just another part of the blend, an anonymous commodity. This loss of identity seemed a shame, given its origin. The soil minerals and sweetness of this county's grass must impart their own flavor to the milk, just as the regions of France flavor their named denominations of wine. David came in from the cornfield shortly after milking time. He laughed at himself for having lost track of time, as Elsie predicted, while communing with his corn. We stood for a minute, retracting the distances between our lives. Both David and Elsie are possessed of an ageless, handsome grace. Elsie is the soul of unconditional kindness, while David sustains a deadpan irony about the world and its inhabitants, including his colleagues, who wear the free caps with Cargill or Monsanto logos. He says, at least they let you know who's controlling their frontal lobes. David and Elsie live and work in exactly the place they were born. In his case, the same house and farm. It's a condition lamented in 1,000 country music ballads, but seems to have worked out well for this couple. We carried dishes of food from the kitchen to a picnic table under the cherry trees. Hirsch joined us, settling Noah into a high chair, while Emily brought a pitcher of milk from the tank in the barn. Obviously, this family had the genes to drink it. For the first time in a while, I had CT13910 gene envy. Dinner conversation roamed from what we'd seen growing in Canada to what's new for U.S. farmers. David was concerned about the National Animal Identification System, through which the USDA now plans to attach an ID number and global positioning coordinates to every domestic animal in the country. Anyone who owns even one horse, chicken, cow, or canary will be required by law to get onto the map and this federal database. Farmers aren't cottoning to the plan, to put it mildly. Mark Twain's wisdom comes to mind, David observed. Sometimes I wonder whether the world is being run by smart people who are putting us on, or by imbeciles who really mean it. But in truth, he's not too worried, as he doubts the government will be up to the job. Forcing 500,000 farmers to register every chicken and cow, he predicts, will be tougher than getting Afghan farmers to quit growing poppies. The steer that had contributed itself to the meatballs on our plates had missed the sign-up. Everything else on the table was also a local product. The peas we'd just shelled, the salad picked 10 minutes earlier, the strawberries from their daughter. I asked Elsie how much food they needed from outside the community. Flour and sugar, she said, and then thought a bit. Sometimes we'll buy pretzels for a splurge. It crossed my mind that the world's most efficient psychological evaluation would have just the one question, define splurge. I wondered how many more years I'd have to stay off Belgian chocolate before I could attain Elsie's self-possession. I still wanted the moon, really, and I wanted it growing in my backyard. After dinner, the long evening of midsummer still stretched ahead of us. David was eager to show us the farm. We debated the relative merits of hitching up David's team and driving the wagon versus our hybrid gas-electric vehicle, new to us, now on its first road trip. The horses had obvious appeal, but David and Hirsch had heard about the new hybrids and were eager to check out this technology. David confessed to having long ago dreamed up, while cultivating his corn, the general scheme of harnessing the friction from a vehicle's braking, capturing that energy to assist with forward momentum. Turns out, Toyota was right behind him on that. We piled into the vehicle that does not eat oats and rode up the dusty lane past the milking barn, up a small rise into the fields. As Elsie had said, the drought here was manifest. The animal pastures looked parched, though David's corn still looked good, or fairly good, depending. The lane divided two fields of corn that betrayed different histories. The plot on our left had been conventionally farmed for 30 years before David took the helm. On our right lay soil that had never known anything but manure and rotation. The disparity between the two fields was almost comically dramatic, like a 1950s magazine ad, except that new and improved was not the winner here. Now David treated both sides identically, but even after a decade, the corn on the forever organic side stood taller and greener. The difference is an objective phenomenon of soil science. What we call soil is a community of living, mostly microscopic organisms in a nutrient matrix. Organic farming, by definition, enhances the soil's living and non-living components. Modern conventional farming is an efficient reduction of that process that adds back just a few crucial nutrients of the many that are removed each year when biomass is harvested. At first, it works well. Over time, It's like trying to raise all children on bread, peanut butter, and the same bedtime story every night for 10 years. If they cry, give them more bread, more peanut butter, and the same story twice. An observer from another planet might think all the bases were covered, but a parent would know skipping the subtleties adds up to slow starvation. In the same way, countless micronutrients are essential to plants. Chemicals that sterilize the soil destroy organisms that fight plant diseases, aerate, and manufacture fertility. Recent research has discovered that just adding phosphorus, the P in all NPK fertilizers, kills the tiny filaments of fungi that help plants absorb nutrients. The losses become most apparent in times of stress and drought. So many people were taken in by the pesticide herbicide propaganda, David said. Why would we fall for that? He seemed to carry it like an old war wound, the enduring damage done to this field. By we, he means farmers like himself, though he didn't apply the chemicals. He came of age early in the era of ammonia-based fertilizers and DDT, but still never saw the intrinsic logic in poisoning things to make a farm. As we crested the hill, he suddenly motioned for us to stop, get out, and look. We'd caught a horned lark in the middle of his courtship display. He shot straight up from the top of a little knoll in the corn and hovered high in the sky, singing an intense, quivery question mark of a song. Will she? Please, will she? He hung there above us against the white sky in a breathless suspense until, zoom, his flight dance climaxed suddenly in a nosedive. We stood in the bronze light, impressed into silence. We could hear other birds, which Elsie and David distinguished by their evening songs, vesper and grasshopper sparrows, indigo buntings, a wood thrush. Cliff swallows wheeled home toward their bottle-shaped mud nests under the eaves of the barn. Tree swallows, wrens, bluebirds, mockingbirds, great-horned owls, and barn owls also nested nearby. All seemed as important to David and Elsie as the dairy cows that earn them their living. Elsie and David aren't Audubon Club members with binoculars and a life list, nor are they hippie idealists trying to save the whales. They are practical farmers, saving a livelihood that has been lost to many others who walked the same road. They spare the swallows and sparrows from death by pesticide for lots of reasons, not the least of which is that these creatures are their pesticides. Organic farming involves a level of biotic observation more commonly associated with scientists than with farmers. David's communion with his cornfield is part meditation and part biology. The plants, insects, birds, mammals, and microbes interact in such complicated ways he is still surprised by new discoveries even after a lifetime spent mostly outdoors watching. He has seen swallow populations fluctuate year by year and knows what that will mean. He watches cliff swallows following the mower and binder in the fields, downwind, snapping up leafhoppers and grasshoppers, while the purple martins devour crane flies. The prospect of blanketing them all with toxic dust, even once, let alone routinely, strikes him as self-destructive, like purposefully setting fire to his crops or barn. David and Elsie were raised by farmers and are doing the same for another generation. Throughout the afternoon, their children, in-laws, and grandchildren flowed in and out of the yard and house, the adults consulting about shared work, the barefoot kids sharing a long game of cousins and summer. Now we stopped in to meet the son and daughter-in-law whose house stood just beyond David's cornfield. As we stayed into evening, conversation on the porch debated the most productive pasture grass rotations for cattle. Out in the yard, it was mostly about whose turn it was for the tire swing. Many months later, when I described this visit to a friend, he asked acerbically, "What, not even a mosquito to bother heaven?" He also mentioned the name Andy Griffith. Probably there were mosquitoes. I don't remember. I do know this family has borne losses and grief, just like the rest of us. But if they are generally content, must such a life inevitably be dismissed as mythical or else merely quaint? Urban people may be allowed success, satisfaction, and consequence all at once. Members of David and Elsie's extended family share work they love and impressive productivity. They are by no means affluent, but seem comfortable with their material lot, and more importantly, for farmers, are not torn by debt or drained by long commutes to off-the-farm jobs. They work long hours, but value a life that allows them to sit down to a midday lunch with family, or stand outside the barn after the evening milking and watch swallows come in to roost. They belong to a surprisingly healthy community of similar small farms. Undoubtedly, some people in the neighborhood have their ludicrous grudges, their problem children, their disputed fence lines. They are human. But they are prospering modestly by growing food. At a vegetable auction in town, farmers sell their produce wholesale to restaurants and regional grocery chains. Nothing travels very far. The farmers fare well on the prices, and buyers are pleased with the variety and quality, starting with bedding plants in May, proceeding through all the vegetables, ending with October pumpkins and apples. The nearby food co-op sells locally made cheeses, affordably priced. The hardware store sells pressure canners and well-made tools, not mechanical singing fish. It sounds like a community type that went extinct a generation ago, but it didn't, not completely. If a self-sufficient farming community has survived here, it remains a possibility elsewhere. The success of this one seemed to hinge on many things, including steady work, material thrift, flexibility, modest expectations, and careful avoidance of debt, but not including miracles, as far as I could see. Unless, of course, we live in a country where those qualities have slipped from our paddock of everyday virtues over to the side of miracle. I couldn't say. It was dark by the time we headed back through the cornfield to Elsie and David's house. At low speeds, our car runs solely on battery, so it's spookily quiet, as if the engine had died but you're still rolling along. We could hear night birds and the tires softly grinding dust as we turned into the field. "Stop here," David said suddenly. "Pull ahead just a little, so the headlights are pointing up into the field. Now turn off the headlights." The field sparkled with what must have been millions of fireflies, the most I've ever seen in one place. They'd probably brought their families from adjacent states into this atrazine-free zone. They blinked densely, randomly, an eye full of frenzied stars. "Just try something," David said. "Flash the headlights one time, on and off." What happened next was surreal. After our bright flash, the field went black, and then, like a wave, a million lights flashed back at us in unison. Whoa! To convince ourselves this was not a social hallucination, we did it again and again, hooting every time, so pleased were we with our antics. It's a grand state of affairs to fool a million brainless creatures all at the same time. After 5 or 6 rounds, the fireflies seemed to figure out that we were not their god, or they lost their faith, or at any rate went back to their own blinky business. David chuckled. Country kid fireworks. We sat in the dark until after midnight, out in the yard under the cherries, talking about the farm bill, our kids, religion, the future, books, writing. In his spare time, a concept I can hardly imagine for this man. David is a writer and editor of Farming Magazine, a small periodical on sustainable agriculture. We could have talked longer, but thought better of it. People might sometimes wish to sleep in, but cows never do. In the morning, I woke up in the upstairs bedroom, aware of a breeze coming through the tall windows, sunlight washing white walls, a horse clop-clopping by on the road outside. I had the sensation of waking in another country, far from loud things. Lily went outside to the chicken coop to gather eggs, making herself right at home. We ate some for breakfast, along with the farm's astonishingly good oatmeal sweetened with strawberries and cream. This would be a $20 all-natural breakfast on the room service menu of some hotels. I pointed this out to David and Elsie, that many people think of such food as an upper-class privilege. David laughed. "Oh, we eat fancy food all right. Organic oatmeal out of the same bin we feed our horses from." We packed up to leave, reminding one another of articles we meant to exchange. We vowed to come again and hoped they'd come our way too. Though that is less likely because they don't travel as much as we do. Nearly all their trips are limited by the stamina of the standard-bred horses that draw their buggy. David and Elsie are Amish. Before I had Amish friends, I imagined unbending constraints or categorical aversions to such things as cars, hybrid or otherwise. Like many people, I needed first-hand acquaintance to educate me out of religious bigotry. The Amish don't oppose technology on principle, only particular technologies they feel would change their lives for the worse. I have sympathy for this position. A good many of us, in fact, might wish we'd come around to it before so much noise got into our homes. As it was explained to me, the relationship of the Amish with their technology is to strive for what is appropriate, making that designation case by case. When milking machines came up for discussion in David and Elsie's community, the dairy farmers pointed out that milking by hand involves repeatedly lifting 80-pound milk cans, limiting the participation of smaller-framed women and children. Milking machines were voted in because they allow families to do this work together. For related reasons, most farmers in the community use tractors for occasional needs like pulling a large wagon or thresher. One tractor can thus handle the work on many farms. But for daily plowing and cultivating, most prefer the quiet and pace of a team of Percherons or Belgians. David summarizes his position on technology in one word, boundaries. He says, "The workhorse places a limit on the size of our farms, and the standard-bred horse-drawn buggy limits the distance as we travel. This is basically what we need. This is what keeps our communities healthy." It makes perfect sense, of course, that limiting territory size can yield dividends in appreciation for what one already has and the ability to manage it without debt. The surprise is to find whole communities gracefully accepting such boundaries inside a nation that seems allergic to limitations, priding itself instead on the freedom to go as far as we want, as fast as we can, and buy until we run out of money. Or longer if we have credit cards. Farmers like Elsie and David are a link between the past and future. They've declined to participate in the modern century's paradigm of agriculture, and of family life for that matter, as they place high value on non-material things like intergenerational family bonds, natural aesthetics, and the pleasures of shared work. By restraining their consumption and retaining skills from earlier generations of farmers, they are succeeding. When the present paradigm of extractive farming has run its course, I don't foresee crowds of people signing up for the plain wardrobe, but I do foresee them needing guidance on sustainable agriculture. I realized this several years ago when David and Elsie came to our county to give an organic dairy workshop at the request of dairy farmers here who were looking for new answers. It was a discouraged lot who attended the meeting, most of them nearly bankrupt, who'd spent their careers following modern dairy methods to the letter: growth hormones, antibiotics, mechanization. David is a deeply modest man, but the irony of the situation could not have been lost on him. There sat a group of hard-working farmers who'd watched their animals, land, and accounts slide into ruin during the half-century since the USDA declared as its official policy, "Get big or get out." And there sat their teacher, a farmer who'd stayed small. Small enough, anyway, he would never have to move through his cornfield too quickly to study the soil or hear the birds answer daylight with their song.
Losing the Bug Arms Race by Stephen Hoppe. What could be simpler? Spray chemicals to kill insects or weeds, increase yields, reap more produce and profits, grow the bottom line by spraying the current crop. From a single-year perspective, it may work, but in the long term, we have a problem. The pests are launching a counterattack of their own. Within one field, an application of pesticides will immediately reduce insect populations, but not eliminate them. Depending on the spray density and angle, wind, proximity to the edge of the field, and so forth, bugs get different doses of the poison. Those receiving a lethal dose are instant casualties. Which bugs stay around? Obviously, those lucky enough to duck and cover. Also, a few of those who did get a full, normally lethal dosage, but who have a natural resistance to the chemicals. If their resistance is genetic, that resistance will come back stronger in the next generation. Over time, with continued spraying, the portion of the population with genetic resistance will increase. Eventually, the whole population will resist the chemicals. This is a real-world example of evolution, and whether or not it's showing up in textbooks, it is going strong in our conventional agriculture. More than 500 species of insects and mites now resist our chemical controls, along with over 150 viruses and other plant pathogens. More than 270 of our recently developed herbicides have now become ineffective for controlling some weeds. Some 300 weed species resist all herbicides. Uh-oh. Now what? The standard approach has been to pump up the dosage of chemicals. In 1965, United States farmers used 335 million pounds of pesticides. In 1989, they used 806 million pounds. Less than 10 years after that, it was 985 million. That's 3.5 pounds of chemicals for every person in the country at a cost of $8 billion. 20% of these approved-for-use pesticides are listed by the Environmental Protection Agency as carcinogenic in humans. So, how are the bugs holding out? Just fine. In 1948, when pesticides were first introduced, farmers used roughly 50 million pounds of them and suffered about a 7% loss of all their field crops. By comparison, in 2000, they used nearly 1 billion pounds of pesticides. Crop losses? 13%. Biologists point out that conventional agriculture is engaged in an evolutionary arms race and losing it. How can we salvage this conflict? Organic agriculture, which allows insect predator populations to retain a healthy presence in our fields, breaks the cycle.
Organically Yours by Camille. The word organic brings to my mind all the health food stores I've roamed through over the years, which seem to have the same aroma no matter how many miles lie between them. Sweet, earthy hints of protein powder, bulk cereal, fresh fruit, and hemp. I guess the word organic means different things to different people. When applied to food, not a college sophomore's most dreaded chemistry class, organic originally describes a specific style of agriculture. But now it has come to imply a lifestyle, complete with magazines and brands of clothing. The word has sneaked onto a pretty loose-knit array of food labels, too, tiptoeing from 100% organic over to contains organic ingredients. Like overused slang, the term has been muddled by rising popularity. It's true, for example, that cookies made with organic cocoa have no residue of chemical pesticides or additives in the chocolate powder. But that doesn't vouch for the flour, milk, eggs, and spices that are also in each cookie. Why should we care which ingredients or how many are organic? The reasons go beyond carcinogenic residues. Organic produce actually delivers more nutritional bang for the buck. These fruits and vegetables are tougher creatures than those labeled conventional, precisely because they've had to fight off predators themselves. Plants live hard lives. They don't have to run around looking for food or building nests to raise their young, but they still have their worries. There's no hiding from predators when you have roots in the ground and leaves that require direct contact with sunlight. You're stuck right out in the open. Imagine the Lifetime original movie, the helpless mother soy plant watching in agony, unable to speak or move as a loathsome groundhog gobbles down her baby soybeans one at a time. Starting to tear up yet? Next, plant kingdom heartache. There's no personal space for the garden vegetable. If you're planted in a row of other tomatoes, there you'll stay for life, watching the neighbors get a nasty case of hornworms, knowing in your heart you're going to get them too. If nobody is spritzing chemicals on the predators, all a plant can do is to toughen up by manufacturing its own disease pest-fighting compounds. That's why organic produce shows significantly higher levels of antioxidants than conventional. These nutritious compounds evolved in the plant not for our health, but for the plants. Several studies, including research done by Allison Byram of the American Chemical Society, have shown fruits and vegetables grown without pesticides and herbicides to contain 50 to 60% more antioxidants than their sprayed counterparts. The same antioxidants that fight diseases and pests in the plant leaf work similar magic in the human body, protecting us not so much against hornworms as against various diseases, cell aging, and tumor growth. Spending extra money on organic produce buys these extra nutrients, with added environmental benefits for the well-being of future generations, like mine. Some of the best-tasting things in life are organic. Basil Blackberry Crumble, adapted from a Jamie Oliver creation via our friend Linda, is a great way to use the high summer abundance of blackberries, which in our part of the country are rain-washed and picked straight from the wild fields. Also on the website is the melon salsa. The melon salsa will bring one of summer's most luscious orange fruits from the breakfast table to a white tablecloth with candles. It's elegant and delicious over grilled salmon or chicken.
Chapter 12. Zucchini Larceny. July. The president succumbed to weeds. So did the lost dogs, the want ads, and our county's Miss America hopeful. By the time we returned from vacation at the end of June, our fastidious layers of newspaper mulch were melting into the topsoil. The formerly clean rows between our crops were now smudged everywhere with a hoary green 5 o'clock shadow. Weeds crowded the necks of the young eggplants and leaned onto the rows of beans. Weeds are job security for the gardener. Pigweeds, pokeweeds, quackgrass, crabgrass, purslane, we waged war, hoeing and yanking them up until weeds began to twine through our dreams. We steamed and ate some of the purslane. It's not bad. And, we reasoned, with logic typical of those who strategize wars, identifying it as an edible non-combatant helped make it look like we might be winning. Weed is, after all, an arbitrary designation, a plant growing where you don't want it. But tasty or not, most of the purslane still had to come out. The agricultural concern with weeds is not aesthetic, but functional. Weedy species specialize in disturbed, that is, newly tilled, soil, and grow so fast they kill the crops if allowed to stay, first through root competition and then by shading. Conventional farming uses herbicidal chemicals for weed control, but since organic growers don't, it is weeds, even more than insects, that often present the most costly and troublesome challenge. In large operations where a mulching system like ours is impractical, organic farmers often employ 3 or 4 year crop rotations, using fast-growing cover crops like buckwheat or winter rye to crowd out weeds, then bare tilling, allowing weeds to germinate, then tilling again to destroy seedlings. before planting the crops. The substitute for chemical-intensive farming is thoughtful management of ecosystems, and that is especially true when it comes to keeping ahead of the weeds. As our Uncle Aubrey says, "Weeds aren't good, but they are smart." It's not a proud thing to admit, but we were getting outsmarted by the pigweeds. We had gardened this same plot for years, but had surely never had this much of the quackgrass and all its friends. How did they get out of hand this year? Was it weather, fertility imbalance, inopportune tilling times, or the horse manure we'd applied? The heat of composting should destroy weed seeds, but doesn't always. I looked back through my garden journals for some clue. What I found was that virtually every entry, every late June and early July day for the last 5 years, included the word weeds. Spent morning hoeing and pulling weeds. Started up hand tiller and weeded corn rows. Overcast afternoon, good weeding weather. Tied up grapevines, weeded. And this hopeful entry, finished weeding. Oh, right. It's commonly said that humans remember pleasure but forget pain, and that this is the only reason women ever have more than one child. I was thinking now, or more than one garden. In addition to weeding, we spent the July 4th weekend applying rock lime to the beans and eggplants to discourage beetles and tying up the waist-high tomato vines to 4-foot cages and stakes. In February, each of these plants had been a seed just bigger than a pinhead. In May, we'd set them into the ground as seedlings smaller than my hand. In another month, they would be taller than me, doubled back and pouring like Niagara over their cages, loaded down with 50 or more pounds of ripening fruit per plant. This is why we do it all again every year. It's the visible daily growth, the marvelous and unaccountable accumulation of biomass that makes for the hallelujah of a July garden. Fueled only by the stuff they drink from air and earth, the bush beans fill out their rows, the okra booms, the corn stretches eagerly toward the sky like a toddler reaching up to put on a shirt. Cucumber and melon plants begin their lives with suburban reserve, posted discreetly apart from one another like houses in a new subdivision. But under summer's heat, they sprawl from their foundations into disreputable leafy communes. We gardeners are right in the middle of this with our weeding and tying up, our mulching and watering, our trained eyes guarding against bugs, groundhogs, and weather damage. But to be honest, the plants are working harder, doing all the real production. We are management. They are labor. The days of plenty suddenly fell upon us. On the same July 4th weekend, we pulled 74 carrots, half a dozen early onions, and the whole garlic crop. Garlic is fall planted, braving out the winter under a cover of straw. We dug our first 2 pounds of gorgeous new potatoes, red-skinned with yellow flesh. With the very last of the snap peas, we gathered the earliest few silvery fir tree and Sophie's Choice tomatoes, followed by 10 more the next day. Even more thrilling than the tomatoes were our first precious cucumbers. We'd waited so long for that cool green crunch. When we swore off transported vegetables, we'd quickly realize this meant life without cukes for most of the year. Their local season is short, and there's no way to keep them around much longer except as pickles. So what if they're mostly just water and crunch? I'd miss them. The famine ended July 6th when I harvested 6 classic dark green market moors, 2 Suyo Longs, an Asian variety that's serpentine and prickly, and 25 little mini whites, a gourmet cucumber that looks like a fat snow-white dill pickle. The day after tomorrow, we would harvest this many again, and every few days after that, too, for a month or more if they didn't succumb to wilt and beetles. Cucumbers became our all-day, all-summer snack of choice. We would try to get tired of them before winter. A pounding all-day rain on the 7th kept me indoors, urging me to get reacquainted with my desk where some deadlines were lurking around. When evening came for a change, I was not too worn out from garden labor to put time into cooking up a special meal. We used several pounds of cucumbers and tomatoes to make the summer's first gazpacho, our favorite cold soup, spiced with plenty of fresh cilantro. To round out the meal, we tossed warm orzo pasta with grated cheese, lots of fresh-picked basil, and several cups of shredded baby squash. After 3 months of taxing our creativity to feed ourselves locally, we had now walked onto Easy Street. The squash-orzo combination is one of several disappearing squash recipes we would come to depend on later in the season. It's a wonderfully filling dish in which the main ingredient is not really all that evident. Guests and children have eaten it without knowing it contains squash. The importance of this will soon become clear. By mid-month, we were getting a dozen tomatoes a day, that many cucumbers, our first eggplants, and squash in unmentionable quantities. A friend arrived one morning as I was tag-teaming with myself to lug 2 full bushel baskets of produce into the house. He pronounced a biblical benediction, "The harvest is bountiful and the labors few." I agreed, of course, but the truth is I still had to go back to the garden that morning to pull about 200 onions, our year's supply. They had bulbed up nicely in the long midsummer days and were now waiting to be tugged out of the ground, cured, and braided into the heavy plaits that would hang from our kitchen mantle and infuse our meals all through the winter. I also needed to pull beets that day, pick about a bushel of green beans, and slip paper plates under 2 dozen ripening melons to protect their undersides from moisture and sow bugs. In another week, we would start harvesting these, along with sweet corn, peppers, and okra. The harvest was bountiful, and the labors were blooming endless. However high the season, it was important for us to remember we were still just gardeners feeding ourselves and occasional friends, not commercial farmers growing food as a livelihood. That is a whole different set of chores and worries. But in our family's year of local, the distinction did blur for us somewhat. We had other jobs, but when we committed to the project of feeding ourselves and reporting here the results, that task became a significant piece of our family livelihood. Instead of the normal modern custom of working for money that is constantly exchanged for food, we worked directly for food, skipping all the middle steps. Basically, this was about efficiency, I told myself, and I still do, on days when the work seems as overwhelming as any second job. But most of the time, that job provides rewards far beyond the animal vegetable paycheck. It gets a body outside for some part of every day to work the heart, lungs, and muscles you wouldn't believe existed, providing a healthy balance to desk jobs that might otherwise render us chair potatoes. Instead of needing to drive to the gym, we walk up the hill to do pitchfork free weights, weed pull yoga, and hoe master. No excuses. The weeds could win. It is also noiseless in the garden. Phoneless, meditative, and beautiful. At the end of one of my more ragged afternoons of urgent faxes from magazine editors or translators, copy that must be turned around on a dime, incomprehensible contract questions, and baffling requests from the IRS that are all routine parts of my day job, I relish the short commute to my second shift. Nothing is more therapeutic than to walk up there and disappear into the yellow-green smell of the tomato rows for an hour to address the concerns of quieter, more manageable colleagues. Holding the soft, viney limbs as tender as babies' wrists, I train them to their trellises, tidy the mulch at their feet, inhale the oxygen of their thanks. Like our friend David, who meditates on creation while cultivating, I feel lucky to do work that lets me listen to distant thunder and watch a nest of baby chickadees fledge from their hole in the fence post into the cucumber patch. Even the smallest backyard garden offers emotional rewards in the domain of the little miracle. As a hobby, this one could be considered bird watching with benefits. Every gardener I know is a junkie for the experience of being out there in the mud and fresh green growth. Why? An astute therapist might diagnose us as codependent and sign us up for Tomato Anon meetings. We love our gardens so much it hurts. For their sake, we'll bend over till our backs ache, yanking out fistfuls of quack grass by the roots as if we are tearing out the hair of the world. We lead our favorite hoe like a dance partner down one long row and up the next in a dance marathon that leaves us exhausted. We scrutinize the yellow beetles with black polka dots that have suddenly appeared like chicken pox on the bean leaves. We spend hours bent to our crops as if enslaved, only now and then straightening our backs and wiping a hand across our sweaty brow, leaving it striped with mud like some child's idea of war paint. What is it about gardening that's so addicting? That longing is probably mixed up with our DNA. Agriculture is the oldest, most continuous livelihood in which humans have engaged. It's the line of work through which we promoted ourselves from just another primate to animal in chief. It is the basis for successful dispersal from our original home in Africa to every cold, dry, high, low, or clammy region of the globe. Growing food was the first activity that gave us enough prosperity to stay in one place, form complex social groups, tell our stories, and build our cities. Archaeologists have sturdy evidence that plant and animal domestication both go back 14,000 years in some parts of the world, which makes farming substantially older than what we call civilization in any place. All the important crops we now eat were already domesticated around 5,000 years ago. Early humans independently followed the same impulse wherever they found themselves, creating small agricultural economies based on the domestication of whatever was at hand. Wheat, rice, beans, barley, and corn on various continents, along with sheep in Iraq around 9,000 BC, pigs in Thailand, 8,000 BC, horses in the Ukraine, 5,000 BC, and ducks in the Americas, pre-Inca. If you want to know which came first, the chicken in every pot or the politician, that's an easy answer. Hunter-gatherers slowly gained the skills to control and increase their food supply, learned to accumulate surplus to feed family groups through dry or cold seasons, and then settled down to build towns, cities, empires, and